Okay, welcome back. Hour number two, Jeff Rentz with Ralph Schoenman. Ralph back again, one of the truly great global commentators and opinion dissector. He's a man who analyzes things in a very unique way. His radio, along with his wife Maya Schoen, TakingAimRadio.com, well worth your time and listening to. Hi, Ralph. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Jeff.
Well, it's, again, every time we get together, things get to be a little bit more outlandish and strange. And it's wild.
Well, you know, we're in the midst of a very advanced crisis of capitalism and its descent into what we call fictive capital. And this is now, the House of Cards is in a very advanced process of collapse. And what is the remedy? Of course, it's the two parties, which are one party, funded by the same folks. And so we have, once again, the illusion of change in the form of reformist talk, and people have expectations, and people reject the last 8 years, and they're up in arms, and they think that Barack Obama is going to address these issues, and they have hopes and expectations, which will quickly be dashed.
Yes.
But, you know, what's interesting about this, Jeff, is that the magnitude of, the unemployment now is reaching into depression-like proportions.
We're looking at
something like 18 million people who are facing, in the real world, are on the verge of being out of work or part-time work that doesn't allow them to maintain themselves, let alone pensions or health care, any of those essentials for people.
I think half Americans,
very advanced.
Yeah, half Americans have no health care insurance.
Yeah. So these things are not going to improve. They're going to get dramatically worse, and we can go through that. And here is the selection for Barack Obama, which people have invested a lot of expectation and hope. But as soon as they register that they're being, you know, what we did in our show was soft soap and sell out. I mean, people are very alert to what their situation is. I believe that there will be the beginnings of a very real radicalization in the United States and the unfolding of class politics, because the class realities are no longer disguisable.
Well, this country is utterly split and polarized, and there will be no healing.
It's going to be a very large and mass mobilization and involving really 80-90% of the population. It's not going to be a minority affair.
No.
But, you know, when we look at what this transition team is, of course, everybody is alert to the fact that the chief of staff is Rahm Emanuel. And Emanuel is a person who we know all too well. He is everybody has been quick to point out. He's been a point person for the Israeli state. His father, a wonderful article in the Jerusalem Post, quoting his father, who, as everybody is aware, is a figure in the Irgun, which was one of the brutal terrorist apparatus for, you know, basically death and killer squads who slaughtered Palestinians in their villages and carried out assassinations over a sustained period of time. And the Jerusalem Post was interviewing him, asking him what his expectations were with respect to his son being the chief of staff and whether he would influence the White House in support of Israel. And he said the following. This is an interview with Maariv that was republished in the Jerusalem Post. Would his son's appointment be good for Israel? He says, obviously he will influence the president. He says, why wouldn't he? What is he, an Arab? He's going to clean the floors of the White House?
That's a racist statement.
Yeah, you know, it expresses it all, of course. But it's only the little beginning, because the role of this man has been manifest. He was the point person for the privatizations and for NAFTA. He organized the funding for 33 candidates for the Democratic Party who were who were in support of an attack on Iraq. This is before Bush actually was consolidated in that. Emmanuel, along with the neocons and his associates in JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, is pushing not just for the attack on Iraq. One of the interesting things in the Times of London, it describes how they were celebrating Clinton's first presidential victory, Rahm Emanuel, who was his chief fundraiser, began to reel off the names of people who had crossed him, and quoting from the Times, he grabbed a steak knife, began plunging it into the table, shouting, dead, 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 after each name. When he was done, the table looked like a lunar landscape. It was something out of The Godfather. But that's Rahm for you, Times of London.
Well, he learned from his daddy.
Yep. And then, you know, you have an interesting report that comes out of Lebanon, which was repeated by something called the Middle East Media Research Institute, MEMRI, which is actually a military intelligence outlet of the Israelis.
Right.
The Lebanese journalist Hassan Hamadad described Rahm Emanuel as an officer of the Israeli Mossad. Now, that makes sense, because after all, he's a key figure who had fought in the volunteered for the IDF, the Israeli so-called Israeli Defense Forces, at the time of the first Gulf War. So here is the a key figure, not only in the Zionist apparatus, but in the entire agenda for fragmenting the Middle East. And he's, Rahm Emanuel had been one of the coordinators, along with a favorite of Obama's, Chuck Hagel, for preparing an attack on Iran. And, you know, he coordinated and basically shepherded Barack Obama for the speech he gave to APEC, which you and I discussed when we were on the air together last, an outright embrace of the essential role of the Israeli state in American imperial designs. But, you know, Rahm Emanuel, Jeff, is just the little beginning of this cast of
and,
characters.
And what are we seeing already with Rahm Emanuel, his pushing for mandatory, well, I call it what it is, slave labor of our young people, forcing them to register for the what amounts to the selective service. They'll call it some fancy name, and it'll be first 500 hours, then 1,000 hours, then 3 months consecutive. He's doing, they're kind of pushing a template of Israeli mandatory service into our faces here now. These are the beginnings of it.
Yeah, I mean it's a way of compensating for the fact that they want the draft, but they're afraid to implement it as such. But they're going to have a kind of coercive induction process for masses of youth. At least they're going to try to do that. I don't think they're going to get away with it, but they're going to. But that's their agenda. I say not get away with it because they're going to meet with a resistance that they can only be. We've seen the taste of it in the the time of the war in Vietnam. But then let's look at so-called transition team that's going to be assembling the cabinet. It's headed by John Podesta, who was Clinton's former chief of staff, and a major corporate lobbyist in Washington. He co-chairs the team, and I'm talking here about lobbying for Lockheed, General Dynamics, all the major military companies that suck at the tit of the American taxpayer for the Pentagon. Chicago real estate executive Valerie Jarrett, who is going to be a co-chair with John Podesta. Then we have...
I just played her clip in the last hour, Ralph, where she said Obama will be ready to begin rule, R-U-L-E, on January the 20th. Rule.
Yes, right. That's the measure. Then there's former Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, who was the point man for the Federal Reserve's operations that lead us to the present crisis of fictive capital. And we have the Citigroup executive Robert Rubin, and then the Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers. Summers, who, if you remember when he was at Harvard, decided that women couldn't do math and science because their brains were too small. Timothy Geithner, who's the New York Federal Reserve Bank president, is another of these point people. So what do we have here? It's the same apparatus of Wall Street and the financial houses. Geithner played a central role in the bailout of Wall Street banks and AIG and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and he was the Federal Reserve chief under both Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Volcker was responsible for the shock therapy, which decimated U.S. industry in the 80s and led to the impoverishment of entire regions.
Hold on right there, Ralph. We'll continue this litany of horror. There's no change. And for all these poor Obama Kool-Aid drinkers, they are really in for it. Well, we'll be right back. Okay, back with Ralph Schoenman. We're going through a litany of the advisors. We haven't even talked about foreign policy advisors yet. But,
no, I mean, we should talk. He wants to keep Robert Gates as the Secretary of Defense. It's interesting because he gave an interview, did Barack Obama, to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, and one of the people involved in that interview is the Nation writer Jeremy Scahill, who had done this book on Blackwater, you know, the private security companies. Mm-hmm. And Obama stated that he intends to leave 140,000 of these Blackwater and private contractors in Iraq. We don't have troops to replace them. But he also stated that he would leave another 100,000 troops. So you're talking well over 200,000 troops that he intends to keep in Iraq. These were interviews that he did in February and then again in April, and they have been reiterated. And then we have here, it's basically the expansion of the imperial agenda. Biden and Gates have prepared an agenda for carrying out the attack on Iran that many of the people around Bush had been preparing. You have Defense Secretary Gates expanding the preemptive war doctrine now on October 28th at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's a nice irony. Gates declared that the doctrine of preemptive war will now be expanded to include nuclear strikes. And he made extended and ominous parallels between the world situation that Obama will confront, which prevailed at the founding of the Carnegie Institute in 1910, 4 years prior to the outbreak of the first World War. Mm-hmm. He noted, Wall Street was passing through a panic of 1910 and 1911 and facing a credit crisis. And the U.S. had just put down an insurgency in the Philippines at a cost of 4,200,000 American lives. It's interesting. About 2 million Filipinos were slaughtered in that, much like has happened in Iraq. And Gates argues that U.S. is now facing the necessity for an expansion of its military reach and holding out the outbreak of World War One as an indicator of what we have to expect. He also invoked the brutal suppression of the 1892 Homestead Strike, that suppression was carried out so as not to deter Washington from the necessity of its broader war. He noted in August of 1913, Andrew Carnegie said that the measure required today for the maintenance of, quote, world peace is a pledge to unite to carry out the operations that were required. So, I mean, it's an agenda that is, there's nothing disguised about it here. And when Barack Obama describes how he wants to maintain and keep Gates. He's basically signaling that the policies that he has been calling for with respect to expanding the war in Afghanistan and in Pakistan are only the very little beginning. We had that same thing from Biden. When Biden talked about incredibly tough foreign policy actions that Obama is preparing, which will be, quote, deeply unpopular, and called on people to stand behind the president when public opinion turns against him. He's going to need help. Mm-hmm. He's going to need you, not financially. We're going to need you to stand with him because it's not going to be apparent that we're right. And there are going to be a lot of you who want to go, whoa, wait a minute, whoa, we didn't sign on for that decision. But he said those decisions are necessary because, he said, if they were popular, they wouldn't be sound. If they're popular, you know they're not sound. This is Mr. Biden on October 22nd. This is even before the election. He's already signaling that the all of the rhetoric that Obama has indulged in is essentially to deceive the population, and they have to prepare the population for the complete betrayal of those expectations.
We can go back even further than that, as you know, Ralph, when Michelle Obama, in that one speech, said probably more than one, but the one I saw, that she pronounced Americans as having broken souls, and she said there's only one man who can heal your broken souls, and that is Barack Obama, and you must be prepared for the sacrifices he will demand that you make. So this was months ago. This is all laid out. They know where they're going.
Right. You see, because here's the, in essence, Jeff, I think what we have here is a crisis of the system, which is so deep and abiding and has alienated vast sections of the population. Of course, primary among them are the most exploited working people, blacks, Latinos, those who are hardest hit and who are angry, who are disaffected, who are really at the point of no return. They're fed up. They've got to somehow, that Obama's function and role has been to try to co-opt, contain, seduce, delude, mesmerize, and defer the prospect of a turn by people to something outside of the capitalist monopoly of power, the dictate of capital through these two parties. And when we look at the, we've mentioned some of the people who they are going to be bringing in. You have Peter Rouse, who is known as the 101st Senator in Washington circles because of the power he commanded.
True.
Rouse was took the position as chief of staff for Obama at the beginning of his first term in the Senate.
Illinois Senate. Hold on, if you would, Ralph. We're running late. Got to do a break.
Okay.
Come right back. We'll pick it up with Ralph Schoenman in just a couple minutes. Okay, and we're back. Ralph Schoenman is my guest this hour. We're talking about the litany of the same old cadavers, the same old evil criminal gangsters are being recycled once again. It's musical chairs in so-called President Obama's administration.
Jeff, let me mention a couple of things quickly about that, and then maybe we can deal with some of the realities of the bailout and what this portends.
Yeah, please.
Because we'd mentioned this Valerie Jarrett. You know, interestingly, she was the chair of the Chicago Stock Exchange from 2004 to 2007.
Was she really? Three years
and,
the chair. Interesting.
And she was made the CEO of something called the Habitat Company, which is a private real estate development firm. And interestingly enough, with Barack Obama in Chicago, they designated this private company to take over public housing, and they received millions in federal subsidies. Here's the Boston Globe article. It's June 27, 2008, on what this public, so-called public housing agenda, this is nominally a reform agenda for working people, grim proving ground for Obama's housing policy. This is by an article in the Boston Globe by Benjamin Applebaum. It describes the state of 504-unit public housing complex called Grove Park Plaza. 99 units are rendered uninhabitable by unfixed problems. Collapsed roofs, fire damage, mice scamper through the halls, battered mailboxes hang open, sewage backs up into the kitchen sinks. Federal inspectors graded the condition of the complex an 11 on a 100 board scale, a score so bad the buildings require demolition. Grove Park is a symbol, the newspaper notes, in Chicago, of the failures of giving public subsidies to private companies to manage a so-called affordable housing, an approach advocated by Obama as the best replacement for public housing, unquote. Thousands of apartments throughout Chicago, overseen by Habitat, characterized by similar disrepair. It goes on. So we get the picture here of who is really calling the shots in the name of change on behalf of the disadvantaged. And it goes, of course, into figures such as Carol Browner, who was an administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency for 8 years. What is she doing? Well, she heads up the Albright Group, a firm headed by former Clinton administration Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the architect of the blockade of Iraq that cost 1.6 million civilian deaths, according to the United Nations, 700,000 of them children. And when she was asked famously in an interview, when she was actually surprisingly by a major correspondent, those figures were cited to her, and she was asked whether it was worth it, and she said, yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Genocidal maniac, a war criminal, an arch killer of humanity, another one.
So, you know, for people who have expectations of change and of challenge to the oppression and the financial predation through the Democratic Party and Barack Obama, the cruel awakening will not be long in coming, along with the imperialism redux that we've been describing. But, you know, they've talked about, Jeff, the bailout of $700 billion.
$1.8 trillion.
This is marvelous stuff, because when we look at this is the Washington Post here. Mm-hmm. Just a down payment of a multi-trillion dollar transfer of assets. Grand strategies, common denominator, trillions of dollars transferred from common assets to a financial aristocracy. They calculated already at a $5.4 trillion bailout. And the Washington Post, I mean, if you look at the established media here, it's astonishing. I mean, I would have thought I was reading the socialist press. No. A quiet windfall for U.S. banks. Attention on bailout debate. The financial world was fixated on Capitol Hill as Congress battled over the Bush administration's request for a $700 billion bailout of the banking industry. In the midst of this late September drama, the Treasury Department issued a five-sentence notice that attracted no public attention. But corporate tax lawyers quickly realized the enormous implications of the document. Mm-hmm. The administration officials, with the support of the Democratic Party, had just given American banks a windfall of as much as $140 billion at a crack. Mm-hmm. The sweeping change to 2 decades of tax policy escaped the notice of lawmakers as they remained consumed with the pressure to accept the controversial bailout bill. When they found out, some legislators were dumbfounded, others furious. Did the Treasury Department have the authority to do this? Every tax expert would agree that the answer is no. They basically repealed a 22-year-old law that Congress had passed as a backdoor way of providing aid to banks. What is this? Section 382 of the tax code? Mm-hmm. What it does is it allows the banks and the corporations to avoid paying taxes on anything that they earn by paying pennies to buy up bankrupt companies with huge losses. and then to cite the losses of these bankrupt companies that they bought for pennies as a basis for avoiding paying any taxes of their own.
But
beyond that, they don't only offset their gains and avoid paying taxes, but they actually get huge cash refunds in the billions based upon the losses that they are citing by these paper and bankrupt companies that they, I mean, this is gangsterism and theft on a scale, and it's with the color of authority. And if somebody steals a loaf of bread or somebody robs a store, they do 20 years. And these guys, you know, $25 billion for Wells Fargo, $140 billion tax theft with the stroke of a pen in a given day. A quiet windfall for U.S. banks is the headline. Not Washington Post, November 10th, Amit R. Paley is the author. And then here in the New York Times, a question for AIG. Where did the cash go? The American International Group is rapidly running through the $123 billion provided by the Federal Reserve, raising questions about how a company claiming to be solvent in September developed such a big hole by October. You don't suddenly lose $120 billion overnight, said Don Vickery of Gradient Analytics, an independent securities firm.
How can it be that this country has become so hopelessly, utterly, malignantly, malevolently corrupted?
I mean, this is a long article, where did the cash go, but it is devastatingly clear. I mean, it is the most brazen, outright theft of what's going to amount to trillions of dollars. And what does Barack Obama and what do the Democrats and Barney Frank and all their Republican enablers call for? They want to double up the ante. They want to extend it now to the automobile industry. They want to, I mean, here's the editorial in the New York Times, Jeff. Do we have time to do this?
We will in just a minute, Ralph. Hold on, we'll pause and come right back with Ralph Schoenemann right after this. All right, back with Ralph Schoenemann. Ralph, let's hear that New York Times editorial.
Right. Well, you know the rationale for this handout of hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars to the corporate and financial criminals who have already lined their pockets with trillions over how long a time.
Right.
The rationale was that this is going to expand credit and get the economy basically stabilized and salvage the banking system. So here's the editorial of the New York Times on October 29, loans. Did we say we do loans? That's the headline. According to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, the chief proponent of the big bank bailout, flooding the banks with taxpayers' money was supposed to get them to start lending freely again. And that, in turn, was supposed to stabilize markets and prevent the downturn from becoming worse and even catastrophic. It's not clear from the start exactly how Mr. Paulson would ensure things would go that way. Indeed, earlier this month, shortly after the bailout was enacted, the Times' Mark Landler reported that Treasury officials wanted to steal out even more bailout billions to banks who were going to use the money to buy up other banks. Lo and behold, with $250 billion in bailout funds committed to dozens of large banks, it turns out the recipients of this investment from taxpayers, they're not interested in expanding credit. They're not willing to make loans. And Mr. Paulson is not at all bothered by their reluctance. Mr. Paulson and the bailout recipients have some explaining to do. In his column on Saturday, the Times' Joe Nocera told about a conference call he listened into between executives of J.P. Morgan Chase, asked about an immediate infusion of $25 billion in bailout funds and how that would change the bank's lending policy. The executive says it won't. There isn't going to be any lending policy. We're using the money to buy up bargain banks. They're going to be great opportunities for us.
So
we have a lot of money we can make.
Cheap banks. I see.
See? They're just bottom feeding, you see, and using the bailout money to enrich themselves in the short term and let them all go bust afterwards. And it says Morgan Chase is not alone. The Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday that bank recipients of the bailout money acknowledged that only a tiny portion is going to be used for loans. All the rest is for acquisitions and profit making. The problem is that the Treasury has refused to put any conditions on the bank's use of the bailout funds. That will maximize bank profits And when they're using taxpayer-provided capital, Congress should have the right to require that the money is used to benefit the public to advance the stability of the economy. The Treasury won't impose any conditions, it says. The bailout is an occasion for the banks to make an unprecedented killing. And an even bigger problem is that the bailout was sold as a way to spur loans. If that never was the primary aim, the public needs to know. The lawmakers should not release the multiple installments that are being proposed. $300 billion here, hundreds of billions of dollars there. The bailout money must be used in ways that put a public interest first, as the New York Times pleadingly. And then you've got the New York Times on today's date, lobbyists swarm the Treasury for piece of the bailout pie. When the government said it would spend $700 billion to rescue the nation's financial industry, it seemed to be an ocean of money. But after the biggest lobbying freefall in memory, it looks like a dwindling pool. Supplicants are lining up for an infusion of even more capital. Hundreds of billions of dollars are channeled to beneficiaries like American International Group and soon American Express. And it goes on.
Yeah, American Express has gotten permission now by the Fed to become a commercial bank.
Yes, that's exactly what the article exposes, that a lot of these companies are simply putting on the hat of banker, grabbing these billions of dollars and pocketing them, either pocketing them or looking around for cheap buys to make and to make huge profits on and then to dump them. The lobbying frenzy is worrying some. It may undermine the government's efforts to stabilize the financial system in its worst crisis since
the
1930s.
And people keep staring at their televisions and thinking Obama's going to bring them change.
Well, they're in for a very quick and rude surprise, Jeff. And the article says by the time they get to the community banks, there won't be enough money left, said Edward Yingling, the president of the American Bankers Association. The marketplace is looking at this so rapidly that those who get the money first have got an advantage. Adding to the frenzy is the possibility that there won't be enough money to go around for all those who are lined up for more. The Treasury announced it would eject an additional $40 billion into AIG.
Why not?
Amid signs that the government's original bailout plan had already been grabbed up by the company. Then there's the National Marine Manufacturers Association, which is asking why boat financing companies shouldn't be getting these bailouts as well. And the National Automobile Dealers Association
is saying the car
dealers have got to get their part of the action, too.
They're going to be discriminatory lawsuits filed. You watch.
Pardon me?
They're going to be discriminatory lawsuits filed. You watch.
Yeah. It says industrial lenders like GE Capital and GMAC, the financing arm of General Motors, are reclassifying themselves as banks. Huh? I mean, this
banks too. Well, Goldman Sachs is—they're going to be banks, and everybody, Ralph and Jeff, ought to open a bank.
Yeah. But they, who's going to? I mean, they're going to loot and loot and loot, and then head for the hills. And here's the assessment. Bailout for the banks, layoffs for workers. This is today's day. Working people in the United States are confronting a wave of layoffs that is sweeping through every sector of the economy with devastating social implications. Mm-hmm. The same prospect is confronting workers in a host of other countries. The U.S. economy is shedding 250,000 jobs a month. The ranks of those officially accounted as unemployed have swollen to more than 10 million. 6 million more have been relegated to involuntary part-time work, which is very temporary, and 2 million have fallen off the charts because they've ceased looking for jobs. Younger workers trying to get their first job are finding the door slammed shut. 1 out of 8 American workers is now unemployed, underemployed, and this is, economists acknowledge, is only the onset and the beginning of what looks like it will be a very cold winter. 18 million workers facing unemployment in deep trouble. In the first week of this month alone, a range of companies announced a combined total of 15,000 layoffs. The German-owned parcel delivery company DHL Express announced it is ceasing domestic shipping operations, wiping out 9,500 jobs, turning Wilmington, Ohio into a ghost town. On the same day, the electronics retailer Circuit City filed for bankruptcy, laying off 7,000 workers, it announced a week ago, and closed 155 stores. Financial analysts, industry executives told the Financial Times of London that budget plans for the financial industry entail another immediate 70,000 layoffs. This goes on. So in the midst of this rapine looting on the part of the financial conglomerates with the, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil of these purchased congresspeople and functionaries, you have the combined circumstance of the virtual looting of the Treasury in the midst of a crisis where the fictive capital economy is in rapid decomposition.
Correct.
So what flows from that? Here's an ardent supporter of Barack Obama, a black journalist in the New York Times named Bob Herbert, who's written a column yesterday called Beyond the Fat Cats. The fat cats who place the entire economy at risk with greed and manic irresponsibility are claiming every last dime of the national treasury. Meanwhile, we're nowhere close to anything resembling an economic recovery program that can help people hurting the most. Back in September, the credit markets frozen, the stock markets panicking, the Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson telling anyone who would listen that the $700 billion bailout package had to be passed with lightning speed. No time to look at it closely. No room for dissent. Now we learn that while all eyes were focused on this new burden for American taxpayers, Mr. Paulson was engineering what the Washington Post described as a quiet windfall for U.S. banks. Virtually no public attention. Without any nominal input from Congress, the Treasury has made changes in the obscure tax provision that provided banks to the tune of well over $100 billion on the first day. No proper scrutiny. How is it possible for people to know? We've learned that the government bailout of the giant insurer, American International Group, already more than $100 billion, is insufficient, and tens of billions of more are being allocated.
Mm-hmm.
When this champagne and caviar crowd is in trouble, there is no conceivable limit to the amount of the taxpayers' money that is found and found swiftly. But when it comes to ordinary citizens in dire situations, those thrown out of work, forced from their homes by foreclosure, driven into bankruptcy because of illness, lacking health insurance, then they start pinching the pennies. That's when they become fiscally conservative. Bush even vetoed a bill that would have expanded health insurance for children. Trillions of dollars for a ridiculous war, pompous, self-righteous high rollers who wreck their companies and the economy. What about the working poor? What about our youth being clobbered in the downturn, battered so badly they're all but destitute? In an article on Sunday, the Times mentioned a young woman in Philadelphia.
Ralph, hold on. We have to pause
right
there. That was an amazing couple of pieces of... And this is actually in the media, folks. So you can find reality in the press if you look for it. It's there. Thank you for citing those, and thanks for being here. And
let me mention one last thing, Jeff, as we close. When Bill Clinton and Barack Obama appeared in Orlando, Florida...
20 seconds. Hurry up, Ralph, if you can.
Right. They appeared together in Orlando, Florida on the eve of the election.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clinton was giving a speech supporting Barack Obama, and he suddenly stopped and he said, Barack may be angry at me for saying this so close to the election.